Welcome, ladies and gentlemen. Great to have you with us. Thank you for tuning in. I hope you're well today. If you're a regular listener, you might recall that I'm Henrik Palmgren and that we are based out of the west coast of Sweden. If you're new to the program, however, I suggest that you take a look at our websites for much more information. RedIceCreations.com, and that's spelled R-E-D-I-C-E, RedIceCreations.com, and also RedIceMembers.com. All right, well, today's program is with none other than Joseph P. Farrell and Scott D. DeHart. Scott has spent the last 20 years as a writer, teacher, professor, and researcher. He has dedicated much of the last two decades of his life as a college professor and is also an author and a high school English teacher. Joseph P. Farrell has been with us many times before. He has a Bachelor's of Arts in Biblical Studies and Philosophy, a Master's of Arts in History and Theological Studies, and a PhD in Patristics. He is the author of many books in the field of alternative research. Today, Scott and Joseph will discuss their co-authored book, Transhumanism, a Grimoire of Alchemical Agendas. We'll go deep into the roots of the old esoteric occult traditions that aim to reunify the fallen, broken man into the ultimate being. And they seek to do this with technology and in the process create a new man. All right, well, welcome back, Joseph Farrell. Glad to talk with you again. Hope you've been good since we last had you on the program.
Yeah, pretty good, Henrik. Thanks for having me back on.
Excellent. And then we have Scott DeHart as well, finally coming on the program with Joseph. We've, of course, talked about you and your work a number of times when we've had Joseph with us. So it's nice to have you with us, Scott. Thanks for coming on.
Thank you. It's nice to be here.
Definitely. So we're going to discuss the book Transhumanism, a Grimoire of Alchemical Agenda here today on the program. And it's been a while since this book came out, actually, but it is a fascinating topic, some one that we've been following for many, many years. And it's a big one, and there's a lot of components to it. And I think what we need to do, of course, as usual, is before you talk about the future of mankind, you need to re-examine and kind of look back into history a little bit to kind of see where we've been and where this comes out of. And I guess we could just do a little bit of a kind of a brief introduction to this topic and where you guys came from when you were pulling together the material for the book. Alchemy, Joseph, we can begin with you in terms of this, I guess. Where do we need to look in alchemy to understand transhumanism today?
Well, Henrik, when we were writing this book, we were both just kind of overwhelmed, I think, really, is the way to put it, by all that we were finding in terms of this idea that you can transform mankind by some sort of technological means. And the further we got into this, it was also apparent that they were talking about trying to transform human consciousness and culture. And of course, that's always been a kind of a theme of alchemy. But we were kind of at an impasse, to be honest with you. We spent one day just kind of pacing back and forth,
yes,
trying to figure out how to write this book.
Right. Oh, yeah.
And it finally dawned on us that what we were really looking at is alchemy in the truest sense. And the reason why is not simply because alchemy is talking about trying to transform the physical medium, in this case, humanity itself, which alchemy tends to view as the physical medium, but also in a much more detailed way, because if you look at Hermetic doctrines, alchemical doctrines, and so on, they basically talk about four stages of humanity. You even find this in Jewish Kabbalah. You have the idea of the four atoms. And at the top of this scale, we have Adam, or the androgyny. And then next, kind of descending from that, we have mineral man, and then vegetable man, and then animal man. So in other words, alchemy, in attempting to transform human consciousness, tries to scale back up that ladder and re-engineer animal man, then vegetable man, mineral man, and finally androgynous man. And all of these things are viewed as kind of fusions. So as we were looking at transhumanism, you know, we were thinking, all right, they're really talking about creating fusions of humanity and other species, and they're doing that, you know, in the laboratories. And we're talking about fusing mankind in the plant world, and to a certain extent, we think that's part of the GMO agenda.
Right.
And then you have the transhumanists like Ray Kurzweil and some others that we found when we were researching that we're talking about fusions of mankind and the machine, computer interfaces, implants, and so on and so forth, and even to the extent of downloading and uploading entire human memories, you know, onto computer disks and achieving a kind of immortality by that means. And so, you know, the more we looked, we were looking at the three stages of alchemy, and that's kind of the reason we decided to choose that title and organize the book around that sort of theme.
Indeed. Now, I've always had a split view on alchemy, I guess. There are many people who have a strong perception that the current transhumanist movement derives it very strongly, you know, from the alchemical agenda and the esoteric orders. Mm-hmm. And I don't think there's a debate really about that. But at the same time, it feels like, to me anyway, that the alchemy that we see today, how it comes out with transhumanism, is a very one-sided alchemy, if we can put it like that. It doesn't seem to incorporate the holistic approach, which seemed to have been part of the original tenets, right?
Yeah, I would agree with that. Alchemy has both an exoteric, you know, operational branch where they're really, you know, trying to create base metals and turn them into gold. And then they have the more esoteric kind, which is, for want of a better expression, a kind of spiritual or metaphysical approach to transforming human consciousness. And I think you're quite right there. With the exception of some of the things that we talked about in Chapter 9 with Shelley and Wilde and so on, with the exception of those people in the arts, you look far and wide in the transhumanist literature to find any real concern for what we would call traditional values or culture, the sanctity of the person or the individual or what have you.
Yeah.
It's almost completely absent.
That's right. Now, Scott, I don't know if this is your forte per se, but the fall seems to be then a very strong point here in terms of where this philosophy and ideology kind of begins, this idea that the original human, if you will, or even if, you know, maybe it wasn't called a human even at that point, a semi-god or something like that, that something has happened in history or prehistory even that has caused some men then and women to try to bring back an older state, if you will, a more godlike person, right? And that's really where things begin, in a sense, right?
Precisely. This, for Joseph and I, when we began, you know, pacing the floor and looking at how to approach the book, we obviously had spent decades in a background with theological studies, biblical studies, various world religions. And one of the things that caught our attention to the whole transhumanistic movement was not just the reengineering of mankind, but what was the ultimate goal, which appeared to be the very thing that most all, particularly the monotheistic religions, begin with, a sense of unity. And from that original unity, a perfect being. And that was really critical for us to look back at both tradition as well as ancient texts from this original created being in a perfect state. What did it look like? And virtually every one of the major religions will take the image of that original, if you like, human or model of mankind and see it as an undivided unity in perfect relationship and very close to knowledge, innocence and knowledge with its maker. So if you have that original androgynous being, which is where most religions begin, and you have a dividing of them, is this the original plan, or is it something that occurs because of an intervention? And it's precisely at the question of intervention, most religions move into the area of sacrifice, sin, and a fall. Thus, the goal with the religions, again, is to reunify that broken fallen image of mankind, reascend back up the ladder to become godlike. And this was a perfect model for where transhumanism and where science, government studies, research, the fusions that we mention all throughout the book Transhumanism, where they all aim to recapture that original undivided, godlike, innocent, and intellectual being. And for what purpose? So yes, you're exactly correct, which is why we start the book with that very idea and move through the image of a biblical fall in terms of a splitting of that first person, and then a fall at the tower, which becomes culturally, linguistically, another fall, or a second view of the same first one.
Right, right.
Yeah, let me add something there, Henrik, because I think there's something else that we need to say that was in our thinking about the fall, and that is we spend a lot of time in the book going over different fall traditions, not just the biblical one, but, you know, the Mayan and some of the others. But let's take the biblical one, since that's very familiar to most people, and look at the story that is recounted of the Tower of Babel in the book of Genesis. In the book, in the book's telling of the story, what it says there is that God or the Elohim come down, and they notice that mankind is building this tower that's going to reach the heavens. And if they're allowed to complete it, then humanity will be able to do whatsoever it imagines to do. And we can't have that, basically, is the message.
Right, exactly.
Given Genesis. So, unusually, in the biblical text, we don't have any mention that this activity is inherently sinful. It's rather, to look at it in a certain way, it's rather a potential threat. And incidentally, when you turn to the Mayan tradition, which emphasizes that original androgyny that Scott was talking about, that just kind of bowled us over, the androgyny itself in the Mayan text is the reason that is given for humanity's, you know, godlike threatening powers and knowledge. So when we were looking at it, the other thing that entered into our thinking as to why we had to approach this from the standpoint of alchemy is, all right, if you're a member of this elite and you're looking at the transhumanist agenda, they would have seen these stories and concluded the same thing. In other words, it's not necessarily inherently sinful what they're up to, so let's just go ahead and do it. So, the fall, the Tower of Babel and the fall play an important part of the agenda in that respect.
Yeah.
And if I can tag on to that, this is not so different from the early Greek philosophical approach as stated in Plato's Symposium, where Aristophanes explains the origin of love and describes humanity again in the same terms. This is a non-religious text, but describing an original unified humanity, male-male, male-female, female-female, which, because it became a threat by virtue of its unity and its knowledge, had to be divided in order to keep the gods from feeling threatened. And at that point that the gods felt threatened, they intervened, and rather than destroy them, because interestingly enough, the argument was, if we destroy them, who's going to bring us sacrifices? We need somebody to make us feel good about ourselves, to worship us.
Yeah, we need somebody to worship us.
Yeah.
Therefore, we can't destroy them again, because then we're left having to serve one another and worship one another, and that won't simply do. So we will divide them so that they are weaker. And then when they were divided, they clung to one another, some afraid to let go, and as the story went, some died from hunger and so forth. But it was specifically an act by the gods to strike and to divide in half these original perfect beings, and by dividing them, weaken them, keep them as servants. And Aristophanes' end of the story is that this is the origin of love, the two halves seeking one another throughout life to reunite themselves and to be that original whole. But it is curious that the story is not so different from the same views that you find in the texts of the sacred literature in Jewish, Christian, Islamic, Hindu, Mayan, you name it. You have the same idea that for some reason, this unity, this sense of completion became a threat, and therefore a division took place. And in that act of division, a radical division that takes place, one which is violent, one which is, in a sense, bloody, it becomes an example, sadly, of what humans might have been, the purpose of love, and what the nature of the gods are like.
Well, this will then, let's say, to bring back something that has been divided in the past. There's, I guess, two different views you can have on this. And one would be that, okay, transhumanism then ultimately is rooted in, to a certain extent, monotheism, you know, despite many viewing this as, this alchemical ideology is kind of occult, it's esoteric. Some would even say that it's satanic, you know. And then on top of that, you have an idea that it's Promethean, if nothing else. It contains the spirit of rebellion within it, or even Luciferian, if you would put it that way. So it's a, what view do you guys take on this? Where does it come from?
Well, I think fundamentally Scott's correct, and this was kind of our approach. We don't necessarily view all of this as satanic or Luciferian on the one hand, but on the other, we don't necessarily view all of it as good either. We're just putting it out there. But I think in terms of this will to recover a lost unity that is so striking in the Platonic text that we presented, this I think is the primordial driving force behind it. And it manifests itself, and we were kind of, to be honest with you, Henrik, we were kind of stunned when we saw this appearing in the transhumanist literature. And it appears without any sort of awareness that what they're talking about is really a religious impulse. It's a spiritual impulse. And this is the idea that, okay, we've got all these technologies coming online. They call them the GRIN technologies, genetics, robotics, information, and nanotechnology. And transhumanists like Kurzweil are arguing that these technologies open up for us the possibility of unheard of vistas for life prolongation or longevity, and also unheard of vistas for the extension, and this is Kurzweil's own observation, I'm not making this up,
right,
for the extension of human consciousness to the universe and to a degree of participation in the lives, the emotional lives and thoughts of others via computer technologies, via implants, interfaces, and so on and so forth. So they're really talking about a recovery of that lost unity. And they're talking about it in terms of, you know, what the alchemists themselves talked about in terms of engineering all of this via a technology, via the philosopher's stone, which the GRIN technologies represent this for the transhumanists. So yeah, I think this is a fundamentally spiritual impulse. I hate to say religious impulse because I don't think that does it service.
But it almost is, though.
It is. This is what they're talking about. It's kind of a situation where technology has become both the means to the end and the end, or in other words, God. And that's the disturbing aspect of it, I think.
Well, there's a two-edged sword that comes down on this, because on the one hand, naturally, the idea of recovering unity and innocence and love is hard to critique as something negative. However, this is what set Joseph and I back and pacing the floor for quite a while on the research, which was, if you were able to manipulate and to a laboratory create such a being what would be the use of it in today's world, given those who would have the technology, the means, and the power to do it? And our fear with this movement was simply that if there was understood, if somebody behind the scenes could see the ancient and religious or esoteric beauty, wonder, and usefulness of such a being, what then would be the purpose of it? And once you let that genie out of the bottle and assume that it's going to work in some degree as a slave in the system to bring about a higher degree of intelligence or such, what happens when that genie is out of the bottle and will not be put back in?
Yeah,
that is the other right. side of that sword, is that go ahead.
No, well, that was, you know, what you're saying there is what led us also to incorporate, you know, Frankenstein, Percy Shelley, and Oscar Wilde and Dante into the book, because this is a theme that they're more or less getting at. You know, we had to, Henrik, when we were thinking about that question, what do you know, what happens if you create such a being? For one thing, it's completely transformative of the culture. It changes instantaneously almost all ethical considerations that you can think of. So, you know, this is a very complex thing. This is why I say we weren't really necessarily concerned to point out merely the evils, but the good parts of this. And as Scott's saying, you know, if you create such a being, if the real reason for this quest is ultimately deeply primordial and to reconstruct a lost unity and love and everything, then we have to wrestle with that aspect of it.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. And I mean, there's a tremendous amount to this alone, and we'll get to this a little bit later in terms of where the development is going today, how even, let's say, legally someone would deal with entities being pretty much, you know, created in a lab out of a bottle kind of thing. But if right. we just bring it back for a moment here to the kind of the basic proposition here, if you will, the implication is as well that there's something wrong with the world as it is. Because if we look, and I know that you guys have you have some interesting stuff here on hermaphrodites and all kind of stuff. We'll get to that. But if we look at everything in nature, we see that it has a division. It's divided in sexes and opposites and everything else. And it's in the experiment of planet Earth, if you will, and nature ultimately, that it comes together as one. It is a unity in that division, kind of, you know, in a kind of oxymoronical way. But at the same time, it implies that something is wrong with what we see in front of our eyes. Is this the stance that a transhumanist and an alchemist ultimately would take, that, all right, something is wrong in nature and we need to put it back together, kind of thing?
I think probably that the real position that they would take, and I think it's one that would have deep roots in esotericism, particularly in that Platonic tradition that Scott mentioned, is the idea that it's not necessarily wrong what we see. It's just that it could be better. Okay?
Right, right.
In other words, that they see this as evolving to something, and the trend that they see evolving is towards this greater unity and diversity. And now we have the technological means to help it along, so let's do so.
it's an improvement, if you will, as they see it, of the natural order, or
right.
when we take so-called evolution into our own hands, if you will.
Right.
And it has the same sort of implications that we look at today with the position of, say, corporations, or from a Calvinistic standpoint, a federal representative over mankind. In other words, speaking of a genie out of the bottle, however, we do have that possibility for creating a cultural and social system that is based not only on the ideas that one could argue are for the best of society, or biblically or spiritually, but in a sense you end up with a class below which acts as a servant to the head for the sake of unity. Right. And once you put this being out there, or you aim for that as the highest standard, which all sounds very good, the reality is we live in such a fallen, corrupt, power-hungry world that the idea, in my mind, that such a new social order could be produced and would not lead to the same form of enslavement is quite dangerous. And in a sense, perhaps our division is the safest means to protect against such a system.
Tell us a little bit more about that system and how you would view that, Scott. I mean, are you talking about, let's say, a development of an artificial intelligence that basically come to oversee and overrun everything, or more of a biological being that is just kind of superior, I guess? What do you?
I think that within the society in which we live, I fear very much the idea that we all become consumed under an all-seeing governorship. That we are stripped of our sense of individuality, of the ability to think for ourselves, to create for ourselves, to press forward with our own life, but rather are incorporated under the head of that which knows best. And we are therefore all connected. And let's face it, we're not that far away from having the means scientifically to remodify the human being from the inside out just by the things we consume and by the technology around us, whether it is through the televisions and the ability for them now, as this was recently, I just read an article on this not long ago, where the televisions are becoming so interactive by virtue of, in a sense, spying on the viewer, that it can adapt the programming for commercials to manipulate under the idea that it's providing a benefit. The audience to say, well, we notice these are your viewing habits, or these are the things that you would purchase, therefore we're going to direct you in this way. So it all seems to be very user-friendly, but from that idea of a very federal headship that is passed down to everyone else, whether in corporation or in religion, when you have that model and then you try to actually create such a being in the laboratory, put it out in society, make it the model, what you're doing is, I think, really just simply putting forth the drumbeat to march as one, and that goes against the very core of what it means to be an individual and a human and a thinking, reasoning, rational person.
Absolutely.
Let me chime in there too, Henrik. I think that there is a danger, as he's saying, of this federal headship and the relation of corporations to all of this. And just to let your listeners know where we're coming from here, this goes directly to the Western doctrine of original sin, that, you know, you inherit a moral culpability for Adam and Eve's sin. And the danger in that doctrine has always been that the individual and his or her exercise of choice, as you can tell from the way that I phrased the doctrine, are completely left out of view.
So
the individual subsumed in this corporation, and you know, when you add all the technology on top of that, as he's saying, that the danger really grows. So yes, I think, you know, we're not trying to say that this whole movement is a good thing. This is the biggest negative to it, and you see it every day. In fact, you know, there's corporations that have now adopted so-called whole person management philosophy, and basically this is just nothing but a euphemism for we want to direct every little aspect of your life.
You make the human being also at the same time into a very predictable kind of, well, I guess we could call it an animal at that stage, right?
You become a commodity, you become the source of profits, but you're not viewed as a human being anymore. And this is one reason we wanted to stress the alchemical aspect of this too, because alchemy, like it or not, you know, whatever one says about it, it does have a distinct and definite place for the individual that runs almost counter to this impulse that we see in society today. So, I think there's so many double-edged swords to this whole movement.
Oh yeah, yeah.
It's really not funny.
Well, I think you can see this out of the time when these movements arise as well. I mean, as you guys, there's just so many aspects here of things I want to discuss. But if we move forward a little bit here, the things that you guys looked at when it came to, you know, Percy Shelley and Oscar Wilde and some of these people, very much dovetailed with some of the things that I've been looking into when it comes to like H.G. Wells and even the Fabian Society that comes springs out kind of under in the same period, if you will, some of this literature. And these today they have kind of branched out, if you will, into different organizations, if you will, or different philosophies. But at the time when you get these ideas in flowing in society, they weren't so strictly branched out yet. And it seems to stem from a kind of a one source, if you will, right?
Well, in the case of, say, Percy Shelley, one of the greatest influences behind his writing, there's really two sides to it. One, and it all centers around his life. One is the aspect of the movement of the Illuminati, which is not to say some type of modern Beyonce sort of nonsense.
I got what you mean when you say that. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. You're talking about this tradition that's steeped in the Jacobins and, you know, the real kind of radical left-wing agenda that came out from the Illuminati, correct?
Yes, I'm talking about the agenda, particularly going back to Ingolstadt and Adam Weishaupt.
Yes.
And that movement which sought to overthrow monarchies and churches, for the sense that what you had was a federal sort of monarchical oversight, which suppressed the individual, which suppressed human reason, human rights, and used threat and fear to control humanity rather than reason and individuality. And so the goal was to infiltrate into those bodies, whether it be secular or whether it be religious, and by infiltrating them, weaken the top-down system so that the individual would overthrow those governmental or ecclesiastical institutions and move out from the tutelage of fear and threat and live as true, full, sort of enlightened human beings. Well, this was a deep inspiration of Percy Shelley, who carried the writings of Weishaupt with him wherever he went. And even on the famous trip in which Frankenstein was conceived in 1816, Percy had these works with him. And the influence of that is, I think, clearly seen in the creation of the monster in Ingolstadt and the idea of, as you mentioned earlier, a Promethean man who would step out and away from the need of a god or a society that's based in fear, but rather one of enlightenment and science.
Yeah.
The other side of that story is simply Percy's life, which was the cost of being that individual, that separated person who thought differently, who lived differently, who was able to experience his own life in his own morals and in his own ways of approaching science. And the cost he paid was to really live alone and not feel as though he was welcomed in society. And of course, he wasn't. From a young age, he was cast out of his house and sent off to boarding schools and then sent off to Oxford, where he was thrown out of Oxford for being an atheist, or at least for writing on atheism, and then pursued by governments and churches until he was either killed or died at sea. So there is both of those at work in Frankenstein, and it's very easy to lay that over the top of Dorian Gray with Oscar Wilde and see again a man who saw the idea of creating a new man and the cost that goes along with it from an author like Shelley, who was himself a bit of a social outcast and lived his final years running from the law, just as Percy Shelley did.
There's something else too, Henrik, that we need to say with respect to Oscar Wilde and how this whole transhumanist agenda is, in a way, rewriting culture. And part of that rewriting is, of course, history, because you look at the literature that Shelley was reading, particularly Adam Weishaupt and so on, Weishaupt, if you're familiar with his literature, his writings, he hints that part of the task of the Illuminati order was to recover ancient lost wisdom. And of course, he's picking up on this idea from the Renaissance Hermeticists and people like Leibniz that were very enamored of the idea, and Newton and so on. So in other words, you had the greatest scientific minds of the century previous to Weishaupt talking about this recovery of ancient lost knowledge, or in Wilde's terms, we were kind of blown away when we reread Wilde from this point of view, because Wilde comes right out and says that the duty that we owe to history is to rewrite it. And I think that I'm convinced, let's put it that way, I'm convinced that Wilde was definitely in this camp and aware not only of what being a new man in this kind of reality, in this kind of culture meant, it also meant looking back at human history and human origins too, and taking stock of that. And that's, of course, what this whole transhumanism book does, is we're approaching the modern phenomenon of transhumanism as a manifestation of a very, very old alchemical, esoteric kind of philosophy and agenda.
Yeah.
Both Shelley and Wilde were deeply steeped to themselves in the esoteric traditions, as as in the science of their day and the psychology that was emerging, particularly in Wilde's day. And we should probably note that today, the 30th of November, is also the anniversary of his death, since we're
interesting.
Bringing
good,
up Wilde.
Good sync, yeah. Now, the new man, if we talk about that concept a little bit, it's been around for a long time. And what I find interesting as well is that when I, you know, read about a little bit about some of the characters here, Shelley and Wilde as well, there's a tie-in with, for example, the Hermetic Order of the Golden Dawn. And again, if we go back to another character that comes out kind of and writing on some of this stuff is H.G. Wells. And I just had to bring up this connection with the Fabian Society, because there is a metaphysical connection in the you know, England at the time. You had the Psychical Research Society, Frank Podmore, Edward R. Pease, know.
These Ledbetter.
Ledbetter, exactly. And Sidney Beatrice Webb, Annie Besant, George Bernard Shaw, Edith Nesbit, she was also a member of the Hermetic Order of the Golden Dawn. But this idea that there is it springs out at that time, a kind of an authoritarian view that something needs to govern society. And it's also the rise of a new man. If you look at the Fabian Society and their writings, you have the New Social Order, H.G. Wells, right? The New World Order. It's very much kind of coming out of that time, right?
Right. Oh, yes, definitely. Definitely. You know, it's spread. I think the main vehicle of the spread, Henrik, in that respect, is via the theosophy movement.
Right, yeah.
Blavatsky and Annie Besant and so on that you mentioned. I think that's part of it, definitely a part of it. And, of course, by the time that you get to the early 20th century, this is turned into the eugenicist movement in the United States. It bleeds over, of course, into the Nazis and some other fascist groups in Europe. It bleeds over into the Soviet Union in the form of New Soviet Man. So yeah, I think that we have to look behind, and really that was kind of another intention of our book. We have to look behind all of these political ideologies and discern the esoteric core that they're all dealing with.
Yeah, precisely.
And on the same line of the early days in the Fabian Society, you also find the name of Edward Carpenter.
Right.
Oh, yes. Yep.
Who did figure rather prominently in transhumanism and was a well-known figure with his work in the studies on human gender, sexuality, psychology, and wrote on Wilde and Shelley.
And the other thing, Henrik, that Carpenter did that we were kind of dumbfounded is that he was one of the first people to speculate philosophically about this kind of corporate person that Scott was talking about earlier, this federal head and so on and so forth. Carpenter actually believed that somehow individual human consciousnesses, when combined, could create a kind of group consciousness or group person. And it's really rather dumbfounding when you read it and see it in his work.
But wow.
It's kind of it's kind of far out, but you know, it's all of a piece of this movement that you say, rightly say, is taking place at the time.
Now, let me ask you guys here, how close you think that the concept of, you know, the new man and the new social order that comes out at that time, how close we are to that in modern day? There's a technology tie-in, there's a kind of a spirituality that kind of goes a little bit hand in glove with this as well. How close are we to those ideals today in society and technology-wise?
On the one side, I would say that the views of a person like Carpenter, who was a close friend of somebody like Whitman, who is pulling in a lot of Eastern and Hindu mysticism into his ideas, is approaching what may sound very similar to today's agenda with a form of unity and social order. But this is really not what inspired them. Their idea of unity was more based on a much higher spiritual concept, one in which there actually was a true sense of spirituality that unified all of creation in a meditative, prayerful, nonviolent way. In today's world, we can use those same terms, but we no longer live with the type of thinkers and poets and scientists who were influenced by a form of mysticism which guided their ideas, whether right or wrong, or somebody holds to the same religious views or spiritual views. They weren't particularly what I would call spiritual men in a religious sense, but in terms of their idea of transcendency and uniting humanity under one sense of love and peace, it's a bit like comparing the 60s movement to today. There's nothing similar to protests today, such as you would have seen in the 60s, though they were both, so to speak, protest movements.
Right, yeah.
So yeah, I've become a little fearful of that.
Right, Joseph?
Yeah, I have to go along with Scott there, Henrik, because the other thing that transhumanists talk about in their own versions of this coming future, they call it the singularity, is some actually perceive that future is going to be a hell. And I think the distinguishing feature for these people, these thinkers, is that they are looking at this technological future that transhumanists envision, and they're seeing no place for the individual.
Exactly.
Whereas if you look at Whitman, if you look at Wilde, if you look at Shelley, and you know, even some of the scientists in the early 20th century that were writing on philosophical topics in a similar way, is you're seeing a real attempt to grapple with how do we preserve the individual, how do we preserve the person in all of this coming unity. So,
and that's gone today. That's what you're saying. That's not there.
Yes. Their spirituality sought to release and to free the individual to be fully human, to step out of the suppressed headship above them, to break forth and to be a full individual. And so their idea of unity was not to suppress it, but rather to say, the reason you're not a full individual is because you've been held down, break forth. And in that sense of liberation, there is a unity that comes about. That was a deeply spiritual idea that came out of Percy, who clearly was not a religious man, but whose writings against tyranny and authority were the very things that inspired Whitman and Gandhi and Edwards or Carpenter, and pushed them forward, just like Wilde, not to say if we would have a larger social unity, we would be a better society. Theirs was, in fact, quite the opposite. The human is so full of potential. What holds it back is religion and law that oppresses them.
It's let me put it in different terms, Henrik. Years ago, I used to teach for the University of Oklahoma, and I had to teach certain courses in quite frankly, philosophy of management. And as a result, I had to familiarize myself with management texts that were used in MBA programs and so on and so forth. And over and over, I kept seeing this whole person management philosophy. And basically, Henrik, all of the spiritual techniques that it employed were to suppress the individual, to lock you into collectivist dogmas or ways of thinking or what have you. And there really was no place for that. You, on the other hand, if you turn to people like Shelley, if Wilde, Carpenter, and so on, they're really trying to grapple with how do you preserve this individual in that kind of culture. So, yeah, you get a very different feel from, if we can use the expression, from the 19th century transhumanists than you do from the 20th century and 21st century transhumanists.
Yeah, it's more social engineering. The psychology is completely different. And as you say, the spiritual component is kind of largely, I think, kicked out the door. And it's very much an atheistic-run kind of ideology, right? So,
well, I wouldn't even say that. I think, really, that under the guise of atheism, the modern version of it has simply disguised its real god, which is the collective. And that's the problem.
Yeah. Now, all right, let's see if we can go into this here a little bit before the break. Scott, I wanted to talk with you about the concept, because you guys talked about this, that, okay, we might be on a necessary evil path kind of thing, that this might be part of the ideology. You talked about, Scott, this idea of Dante basically, you know, climbing up on the back of the devil to like get us out, to get us up to this higher level. But we on the path, we might have to do some bad stuff and dirty things. Is this how they view it, Scott?
I'll probably let Joseph touch on the Dante moment. However, he and I have had many discussions on this because he I think feels a little bit more confident on it. However, on scratching the surface, yes, I am one who takes the position that in order to ascend in a proper way, I would take the Promethean image. There does have to be that sense of reclaiming the right of the individual to stand at his own two feet, to climb up what appears to be the ladder of evil, and I say appear to be, because in a world which is turned upside down, which ours clearly is, the only way up is in reverse. So right. I would take that, and I would say that within the political religious turmoil that Dante is writing within, it's not so different than what people like Wilde and Shelley were also being exposed to, which is to say, I may appear to be evil in your world because your world has been flipped in such a way that to actually speak and to live as an individual requires one to steal the fire that supposedly belongs to one or two at the top and to spread it to the rest. That being said, Joseph may want to touch more on what we used with Dante in the book.
Well, Don, you know, Henrik, we had literally, we sat for several mornings outside of Starbucks in my car talking about Dante and all of this transhumanist theme that, and for that matter, hermetic theme that we find over and over again in literature. And certainly when you think about it, Dante has to be right at the top of the list. And when we say that, we realize that we're kind of bucking the trend in literary criticism, which has been to see Dante as kind of the embodiment of, in a literary form, of the philosophy of Thomas Aquinas and the medieval Catholic Church and so on and so forth. But if you look at the basic imagery in the Divine Comedy that Dante employs to achieve his summum bonum, his consummate division of the divine, he expresses this through a pilgrimage that literally requires him to descend the very pit of hell itself to a personal confrontation with Satan. And the way he gets out of hell is to climb up the back of the devil.
Yeah.
And then you begin the climb of, you know, in the second part of the comedy, you begin the climb in Purgatorio. And it turns out that Purgatory is an exact mirror image of hell. And again, his guide through all of this isn't anybody Christian. You'd think someone like Dante would at least choose Francis of Assisi, you know, to guide him through all of this stuff. But no, But no, his guide is the quintessential Roman imperialist pagan, Virgil.
Right. Yeah.
So you can't look at this basic imagery and come away with any other conclusion, in my opinion, than that Dante is, he'll use Christian symbolism, but the overall macro context in which he's talking is completely opposed to it. And in doing so, he's doing just exactly what Scott was talking about. He's asserting his right as an individual to think as he will about all of these things, come what may. And, you know, I'm four square behind that philosophy, because if you can't do that, then there's no responsibility. If there's no responsibility, there really is no goodness or evil or justice or mercy or what have you. So,
yeah, you're just managed, you know, by whatever that might be.
Yeah, exactly.
You don't take any decision making, and in that process, you know, it's devoid of responsibility, as you say. And in a way, this is kind of where this is ultimately where I see, in a way, that this system that is being built right now, the infrastructure of the technology and everything else, with the some of the propositions, that it's very much about removing the human, well, experience really, but the decision making, the responsibility, and all these things for the sake of security and safety and efficiency and everything else, right?
Absolutely.
I couldn't agree more. It's removing humanity from the equation. I mean, my word, Henrik, let's give an example that people really probably won't even think about. Let's look at the stock market. Right now, and at least for a decade, most of the trading in stock markets has been done by high-frequency trading algorithms on computers.
That's right,
okay?
Yep.
And as a result of this, just consider what this means. What this means is the price of something in the financial markets is no longer a reflection of their real value in the human world. So in other words, they are taking humanity out of the equation. And, you know, the bottom line, Henrik, is they took humanity out of the equation in Nazi Germany. They took humanity out of the equation in the Soviet Union. And so long as you do this, you cannot construct a system that humans can live in.
It's so simple, isn't it? But then time and time again, what happens, you know, look at history, you know?
Yeah.
Well, I think an AI system might have taken over the trading already, actually. And that, you know, a couple of bugs or spiders, whatever you want to call them, bots have been released out onto the market and might be manipulating it enough right now to, well, I mean, for Christ's sake, for all we know, you know, certainly we know that there's human beings behind this too, but for all we know, the major crash and the loss of faith, if you will, in the system might even have been induced by a machine intelligence, if you will, to consolidate money. You know, we don't know.
Oh boy, Henrik. Henrik, I couldn't agree with you more.
Yeah.
For reasons I don't want to get into, but boy, oh boy.
It's fascinating, yeah.
It's also happening in the educational system as well. There's been a recent movement to federalize all of education throughout the United States to test in a way which is leading to an AI form of testing, and to set up the student within a system where their individuality is going to be merged into some type of a technological means which will spit out the future based on what it knows is best. And the system for teaching, what is being handed down, what one is expected to prepare students for in terms of the assessments down the road, is purely a technological, computerized, collective future. And that is where that is heading as well.
We can thank John Dewey for some of those ideas, maybe.
Ultimately, Henrik, you know, the transhumanism movement in this respect, not in the sense that the writers in the early 20th and throughout the 19th century were talking about, even as far back as the 18th and 17th centuries. Ultimately, this aspect of it, it's not a transhumanist movement, it's an anti-human movement.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, absolutely right. Now, gentlemen, let's take a little pause here. This is just, I mean, incredibly fascinating. I want to get into much more here in the second, of course, in terms of the alchemical kind of marriage, how we see some of this stuff implemented today and how we see the human being changed, not only on the psychological level, but actually even on the biological level. So there's much more to get into here. But why don't we give out some website, guys, to your work, and obviously the book, again, just want to mention that, Transhumanism, A Grimoire of Alchemical Agendas. And guys, tell us where the book is available for a purchase.
You can order the book directly off my website, which is www.gizadeathstar.com. You can also get it at Amazon, Barnes & Noble, and so on.
And your main website, Joseph, is of course, gizadeathstar.com. Scott, do you have a website?
Yes, same name as my most recent book, ShelleyUnbound.com. And likewise, the books that Joseph and I have written are there, as well as a follow-up to Transhumanism, which is not available on Amazon or in Barnes & Noble, but Transhumanism and Dialogue, which is a simplified version of the book, which is about 80 pages, which is set in the form of conversation and questions and answers from every single chapter, following along with page numbers to the book Transhumanism, because we found there were a number of people who gave glowing recommendations on the book, but then would follow it up by saying, I didn't understand a word of this section.
Oh, really? It's too technical, too complicated? Yeah.
There were points. There were some chapters that really require, I think, some undivided attention and some background. But we wanted to kind of reach out a bit of help to them and simplify the book chapter by chapter. And that one, Transhumanism and Dialogue, I think is also available on Joseph's website at GizaDeathStar.com. It's on mine, and it's also at lulu.com.
All right, very good. We're going to have these websites up there, and ShelleyUnbound.com, that's got the Hearts website. You have some of the books and titles there. And then, of course, as we said, GizaDeathStar.com. By the way, Joseph, before we wrap things up here, are you working on anything new as well currently that you'd like to mention?
Yeah, actually, Scott and I have talked about some mutual projects. It's just a matter of us finding the time to sit down and get them done. We've got about three different things that we've talked about that we want to do, and then I've got about five in addition to that that I'm trying to work on, Henrik. But I've got to be honest, after I finished Covert Wars and Clash of Civilizations and then doing final edits for Financial Vipers of Venice, I was just so exhausted. I haven't really sat to write anything or research anything of a major nature in the last 2 to 3 months. I'm giving myself a little break. I've been knocking the books out.
You deserve it. Yeah, you deserve it. you've been writing like I've never seen before. I have a copy, by the way, of Financial Vipers of Venice. I'd love to have you back at some point and talk more about that. We can talk about that later. Stay with us, guys. We'll take a short break here, and we'll be right back with more. In the second hour, as we proceed, we talk about the four steps in the declension of mankind, beginning with androgyny and the technological fusion with humanity at each of the four levels. We also discuss modern technology that is presenting questions of ownership and what a nightmare scenario may arise because of it. At what point are we no longer human but owned by a corporation or the state that have modified our genetics? Later we question if artificial intelligence actually already haven't taken over. Yet, in the end, the system is going to be unhuman. Therefore, it means that no human can live in it. What happens then? This is a fascinating continuation with Scott and Joseph that you should not miss. Proceed to listen to the second hour as a subscriber at redicemembers.com. No commercial interruptions, free of ads. This is listener-supported radio, so if you like what we do and want to hear more, sign up for a membership. All right, we'll talk to you more on the other side. Thank you for listening. Take care.